Victoria Price grew up famous and wealthy. Her father, Vincent Price, and she's on a journey to discover herself. She talks with me about her latest book, The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self.
And we have to learn to face our fears. We can't run away from them. Of course, we all want to. I want to every day, but we have to learn to face them. And in that comes this sense of freedom that is not attached to something.
Michael P. Daly tells the story of Bobby Bluejacket, the tribe, the joint, the Tulsa underworld.
In each instance, it was kind of not only what happened, but his understanding and the way he told those stories, which is a mix of very kind of heartrending honesty and then a bit of gallows humor in there as well.
It's time for Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm and click donate. For the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, ProgressiveSpirit.net. I'm John Shuck. This week I have two guests, Michael P. Daly and Victoria Price. Victoria Price is the daughter of the famous Vincent Price, and she has been on a quest in her adult life to find her true self.
But fame was difficult for my mom. My dad was built for fame. Fame was the platform that allowed him to spread his joy. For my mom, it was this sense of duty, obligation, responsibility, trying to continue to promote the brand of my dad and keep him in the public eye in the best way possible. And she didn't want to be in the public eye. She was a designer. And it just made her more and more anxious and tense. And then when I came along, I was like a representative of the brand. And anything that I did that I just was a typical kid thing that didn't fit that panicked her, because she thought, how is this going to reflect on her, on my dad? So I grew up with all these messages about what I should or shouldn't do. And you know, I'm really convinced that the word should has been misspelled in the English language, because to me, it's a four-letter word.
Her book is called The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self. That's coming up in the second half hour of the program. In the first half hour, I speak with Michael P. Daly. He is the author of Bobby Bluejacket, The Tribe, The Joint, The Tulsa Underworld. It's an extraordinary story of a career thief who gained notoriety as a convicted teenage killer, went to prison, educated himself, and came back to be a leader in his community. It's a fascinating story.
He had grown up on Eastern Shawnee land in Northeast Oklahoma, but his father had been rather tortured at the time, and that sent him and his mother and brothers off to Tulsa pretty much when he was a couple weeks old. And, you know, it was the Depression, so it was hard for anyone living in Tulsa or Oklahoma or anywhere else in the United States. But particularly, his mother was quite poor, worked multiple jobs to kind of barely get bread on the table. And so at a young age, about by the age of seven, he had set off to kind of earn for himself on the streets of Tulsa. Now, that didn't necessarily make everything he did illegal. You know, he was shining shoes. He would do a lot of salvage work. His main mainstay was selling newspapers. But I think through hanging through the alleys and kind of darting in and out of nightclubs, things like that, as a little kid, he'd come to kind of admire a lost form of fashion, but at the time was a very specific one, which was kind of that 30s safe burglar chic, you might call it, of kind of fine tailored suits and that certain look. And so he began to kind of lust after that that look and that prestige himself. And that led him to, I guess you'd say, apprentice with various burglary crews by the early 40s.
Michael P. Daly, Bobby Blue Jacket, The Tribe, The Joint, The Tulsa Underworld. Welcome to Progressive Spirit.
Hey, John. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about Bobby Blue Jacket. How did you hear of him?
Well, Bobby Blue Jacket, I had come across by accident, actually. He was a source for another piece I was working on, which was a history of a rather famous photography book called Tulsa by Larry Clark. And through my research, I'd come across an audio recording of a few petty criminals talking, and they were complaining how they couldn't get out of jail quick enough. And one said, well, you ought to talk to Blue Jacket. And that name really stuck with me, so I followed it down a rabbit hole into another rabbit hole, and had connected with Ron Padgett, who's a great poet, also originally from Tulsa. And Ron then connected me with Blue Jacket, and you know, it started off just as an interview for this other project. But after a couple calls, I'd say we became maybe initial friends. He started telling me about his life, and it turned out his life was one of the most extraordinary stories I'd ever heard, and was kind of an interesting reflection point for all these kind of untold histories about our country. So from there, that kind of set the whole thing off.
So what kind of hooked you about him?
Well, you know, there's a lot of wild stories, powerful stories, but it really boils down to his very personality. And, you know, I was interested even before meeting him, the idea of someone kind of looking at U.S. history through a very subjective lens and through a very personal lens. And so I guess what hooked me was the way that he would describe anything from being a shoe shiner in the Depression era alleys to being a safe burglar to being a family man to he was incarcerated several times where he ran prison newspapers, which is a very interesting part of the story. So about his writing career. But in each instance, it was kind of not only what happened, but his understanding and the way he told those stories, which is a mix of very kind of heartrending honesty and then a bit of gallows humor in there as well.
Well, and pretty explicit language that we can't really talk about on the radio, but really he was an incredible speaker and writer, really a poet. Or is.
Yes, indeed. He's.
I should say he is. He's still living. He's still selling tires, yes. Isn't he, in Tulsa?
Yes, he's still around. He is involved in the used tire business and is very very involved in kind of the political and social aspects of his tribe, the Eastern Shawnee. And but speech making is a big part of that. He had actually come upon learning how to give and write speeches while incarcerated. And he had arrived at a time in Oklahoma in the 1950s, when a massive wave of prison reform was going on, and it resulted in the establishment of the first accredited high school behind bars, and also involved him going on trips to Southwestern State College, where he studied speech for the first time, and that kind of gave him a lot of tools to do speeches in prison, where he was the MC of the prison rodeo, which was quite an event. And then later on for the tribe, both giving political speeches, and then he's very famous for his eulogies, which are incredibly powerful reflections on kind of life and death and history, and for him, what it means to be Eastern Shawnee.
Now, he was sentenced to, 99 years in prison for first-degree manslaughter back in 1948 when he was really just a kid, and you outlined that story in one of the chapters. What can you say what happened in that, just briefly kind of catch people up?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, that case was kind of what initially attracted me, and maybe in terms of subject matter, because at the time it was the biggest case as far as the media goes in Tulsa. It was front page news for weeks on end. And the way it was reported was really as if this kind of gangland assassination where he had walked up and gunned down another kid with a shotgun. He did, in fact, kill another boy with a shotgun, but as I dug into the story, it turned out it was this much kind of more murkier situation where there was this kind of beef building up over a few days between two groups of kids, and it really ended up being a situation that was supposed to be a fist fight that kind of got out of control, and he had used his shotgun actually as a club to hit one of the other boys, and it went off and killed him. And this situation completely changed the course of his life. as you might imagine, and it resulted in a high-profile trial and then an initial sentence of 99 years.
And this trial, in a sense from reading the book, was really a trial by media, even before it was a trial in the court. Racism, clearly a part of the story in Tulsa, then the Tulsa media's portrayal of Bobby Blue Jacket, is that right?
Yeah, you know, I don't think the racism was necessarily overt in the press, although there's lots of other parts of the book that have to do with kind of the attempted subjugation of Native Americans and kind of the social racism and biases. But in this case, it was kind of the whole case was framed in both a racial and economic sense, that the boy that died was a affluent son of a white oil man, kind of representative of upstanding Tulsa society, you know, in quotes. And then there was Blue Jacket, who was cast as this, quote, you know, poor Indian boy or Indian gangster. And so, yeah, there was a dichotomy set up like that. And as you said, it was a trial by media in the sense that not a single person who served on the jury hadn't heard or read about the case. You know, that would probably be thrown out today if that was the situation, as, you know, what they call a Google mistrial of people looking up, reading about cases beforehand. But at the time, they decided to go ahead and use those jurors available.
Well, now, of course, he didn't spend the 99 years. How was his sentence shortened, and what was his prison life like?
Well, his prison life was, I guess I kind of describe him sometimes as a test pilot for prison reform in Oklahoma in the 50s. When he arrived in 48 and then in 49, Oklahoma, both in the penitentiary and then Oklahoma State Reformatory, were rather dungeon-like. There were group beatings by guards, conditions were atrocious, food was terrible, kind of violence was palpable everywhere. But Blue Jacket arrived right on the cusp of this political situation that led to the appointment of a new warden, Oklahoma State Reformatory, named Warden Joe Harp. And he kind of took it upon himself to completely reinvent prison life. While, of course, being incarcerated back then or any time is extremely oppressive, both physically and psychologically, Blue Jacket kind of got to benefit from a lot of these new programs at the time, which was, again, a prison newspaper, prison sports, like baseball and football. He's in a prison band, and again, working on the prison rodeo and also doing parades and speeches. So he actually got out from the walls quite a bit, traveled around, and I think these programs kind of gave him a sense of self and a sense of identity. And allowed him to mature such that, you know, simultaneously he's appealing to have his sentence reduced. And I think people saw in him a completely changed person as far as who he was, you know, when he was 17 and 18 before he had gone to prison.
In your view, you certainly interviewed many people before for your work. Would you say that Bobby Blue Jacket and what he says and what he writes rings true for the most part?
I really think it does. I mean, there's a brutal honesty, not only in his assessment of society, but particularly of himself. He's one of the more self-aware people I've met, and is someone that just his writing is just much more powerful than most what you think of kind of maybe, you know, New York, Brooklyn polished novelists or something like that. I mean, there's a real honesty and rawness and realness to the way he writes. And that's one of the things that really attracted me.
Where are his writings collected, or are they? Or are you really the first one to have them in any type of collection?
I guess as far as a collection, I would be the first one. I mean, he's published throughout prison newspapers and then Tulsa newspapers, Tulsa World and Tulsa Tribune. He writes extensively for the Eastern Shawnee, and so that'll appear in some of their publications like the Shooting Star or their Powwow magazine, which comes out every year. But as far as kind of compiling them together and juxtaposing them against one another, this book would be the first one at that. Although I think he, beyond this book, he does deserve a kind of larger bibliography of all of his work. So we'll see what happens there.
If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, I'm speaking with Michael P. Daly. He's the author of Bobby Blue Jacket, The Tribe, The Joint, The Tulsa Underworld. He really started off right away, even as a young boy, kind of In the underworld of Tulsa, what were the choices available to him then?
Well, not many. He had grown up on Eastern Shawnee land in Northeast Oklahoma, but his father had been rather tortured at the time, and that sent him and his mother and brothers off to Tulsa pretty much when he was a couple weeks old. And, you know, it was the Depression, so it was hard for anyone living in Tulsa or Oklahoma or anywhere else in the United States, but particularly his mother was quite poor, worked multiple jobs to kind of barely get bread on the table. And so at a young age, about by the age of seven, he had set off to kind of earn for himself on the streets of Tulsa. Now, that didn't necessarily make everything he did illegal. You know, he was shining shoes. He would do a lot of salvage work. His main mainstay was selling newspapers. But I think through hanging through the alleys and kind of darting in and out of nightclubs, things like that, as a little kid, he'd come to kind of admire a lost form of fashion, but at the time was a very specific one, which was kind of that 30s safe burglar chic, you might call it, of kind of fine tailored suits and that certain look. And so he began to kind of lust after that that look and that prestige himself, and that led him to, I guess you'd say, apprentice with various burglary crews by the early 40s.
And he was an incredible athlete. I mean, before this event that sent him to prison the first time, he was ready to go be a boxer in New York City. And it seemed to me that he might have had a pretty good chance at that.
Yeah, you know, he said, you know, he knew he would never be the best boxer in the world, but he was one of the most entertaining. You know, as you might be able to tell from his speech, he's a flashy guy. He's got a lot of charisma. And so had he not gotten that altercation in 48, that led to the killing, there is a great chance he probably would have made his way in the boxing scene, either in, Philly or in New York.
But even reading his story, I mean, he made of himself, so many different ways. I mean, he really found ways to survive and thrive in the many different situations in which he faced.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And that's kind of what attracted me to the narrative of his life, where I think you read a lot of biographies and it's about this one big arc, and where for him, it's kind of this constant reinvention in different scenarios. And so, yeah, he's a guy that's faced a lot of trials and tribulations, but has managed to make it through each time. And really for the last 20 years or so has been probably the most successful in terms of what he views success as, in the sense that he's got the chance to help out his community, try and take care of his family, and has become a kind of pretty serious figure of serious importance in the Eastern Shawnee community.
Yeah, he's a tribal elder now in Eastern Shawnee. Was there a time in his life when he began to reflect more on his ancestry and his identity and what he wanted to contribute to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, he'd attended the Indian boarding schools, which is part of the assimilation campaign, until about 1944, when he had left Shalako Indian School, and then had really lost touch with the tribe and kind of his sense of identity as it relates to being Native American by that point. When he left prison for the last time in 1993 is when he kind of began to reconnect with the tribe. And some folks had invited him up there, and he began to kind of socialize, and, you know, he found a calling, both in reconnecting to his roots, but I think also he's a very kind of brass tacks, materially focused guy, where I think he saw a way to just help people in their day-to-day. You know, one thing he does now is work on something called the Elder Crisis Committee, where he helps allocate funding to impoverished elders in the tribe, you know, whether it's getting their roof repaired, getting some food in the house, that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I think it gave his life a lot of inertia to move forward in a new direction there.
And we're talking about Bobby Blue Jacket. Michael Daly is the author of Bobby Blue Jacket, The Tribe, The Joint, The Tulsa Underworld. And I know he was working on, for example, the casinos. This has really floored me when he's speaking about how many employed within the casinos and the good jobs are white people. I mean, there was a major a work of injustice that he works against there.
Yeah, his main concern at the tribe, again, is kind of making sure people are paid, making sure there's jobs for people in the tribe. And so, yeah, he's a big voice for those that need help.
So has he read your book?
He has, yes. Yeah, he and I are, I would say, very good friends at this point, probably one of my best friends. So we speak about once a week and talk about parts of the book. And, I think it's been a strange experience for him, as I imagine it would be for anyone to get hit with a hefty book about your life. So it's been interesting kind of hearing him reflect through the book.
Well, you have put a great deal of work into it. I mean, the book itself is nearly 700 pages with extensive notes. How much time did you spend researching this and talking it over with him?
About 6 years. The first kind of 6 months, I didn't even know I was doing a book about Blue Jacket, but I was doing a lot of research into kind of the Tulsa underworld and politics in Oklahoma, that sort of thing. And then for the next kind of 5.5 years, I spent time going to visit Blue Jacket, speaking with him on the phone extensively, and then, of course, as you've seen in the book, doing a lot of research into trial records, prison archives, legal archives, that sort of thing to kind of supplement the main narrative.
And so what would you like people to take away from your book, but the story of this amazing person, Bobby Blue Jacket?
Well, I think there's a lot of lessons to take away from Blue Jacket's life. I guess if I was to step back and kind of think about the bigger picture, one of the reasons I think his story is interesting is we tend to talk about politics or the economy or even social issues as these kind of abstract ideas. But at the end of the day, it boils down to us as individuals and how those things affect and reflect through us. So I hope people read the book and can kind of experience these big ideas that exist in American history in how they're embodied in a human being.
Michael Daly, author of Bobby Blue Jacket, The Tribe, The Joint, The Tulsa Underworld. Mr. Daly, thanks so much for this book and for spending time with me today.
Yes, thank you very much.
You are listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. Up next, Victoria Price talks about her book, The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schuck. Victoria Price is the author of the critically acclaimed Vincent Price, A Daughter's Biography. She's a popular inspirational speaker on topics ranging from art collecting and design to creativity and spirituality, as well as the life of her famous father, Vincent Price. Her latest book is The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self. Welcome, Victoria Price, to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Your book is called The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self. How did this book come to be?
Well, I've always written. And so when I write, it's really about trying to write myself whole, kind of make sense of what's going on by seeing how I explain it to myself through words. So writing was always a part of this journey. I've written my whole life. I've kept a journal. I've written books. I've written for magazines. So it was always a part of that. And the book really was an extension of the main writing that I've been doing during this journey, which is a blog called Daily Practice of Joy. And the Daily Practice of Joy that I created was really part of what I used to change my life and also connect with others. And through that writing, it transformed into a book. And then the book, of course, changed from what I thought it would be, because I lost that original idea and it morphed into another. And that's kind of what happens.
You know, talk about that a little bit more with me, about what happens, because I would say that most folks, and I'll put myself in there, are not particularly self-reflective about our lives that much. We just kind of do them. Our goals aren't quite, you know, finding our truest self. How did you become, if I could put you on the spot this way, so self-reflective about the importance of meaning in your life?
You know, I think because I grew up in great privilege with parents who never allowed me to take that or anything else for granted. And so from my earliest age, I felt like I was surrounded by paradox, by things that were in a way inexplicable to me. Paradox, I think, is a fundamental component of spirituality and seeking. And so I would see one thing. I would see privilege and great wealth, and I would all around me. I would see other things on the news that were horrible and devastating. From the time I was a little girl, I grew up in the 60s, and in the 60s, you watched the body count. You watched people, protesters or civil rights activists being hosed down by policemen. And there were things that just didn't make sense to me. And because all these mixed messages were in my life, I had to try to make sense of them. And I think that is really what began my journey. I couldn't understand the disparity between the message, some messages I was given, what I was seeing around me, what I saw in the news, and I had to understand what the heck was going on.
So what have you found now in your life about a truest self? Is there such a thing? Is it something you find? Is it a peeling of layers of onion, or is there just the true self change over time?
I think that we are all born knowing who we are, not knowing in the sense that we think of knowing intellectually. But we come out of the womb, and who knows where we came from? Nobody knows that. There are so many different hypotheses. But we come into the world with a clear sense of who we are. And we see it in how parents talk about little children. Oh, from the beginning, he loved to work with his hands. From the beginning, she was always singing in front of the mirror. And I think what happens is, and it doesn't have to be that specific, it's what we're drawn to. And so what happens is that we know that, and then there's nothing really in our larger culture that facilitates us holding on to that intuitive knowing, because what we're taught to do is to learn how to become something that the world tells us to be. And so we start listening to our parents, to our teachers, to our peers, to the media, and we begin to forget how to hear our own hearts. And I remember as a little girl, and this is just a silly example, but as a little girl, the two things I loved the most were horses and animals and reading. And I remember getting to my 30s and being in a very fortunate position in my 30s where I had enough financial well-being to be able to choose what I wanted to do when I wasn't working. And the two things that I wanted to do were read and write and be around horses and dogs. And I thought, well, isn't that ironic? Here I am going right back to who I was when I was a kid. But I think those are specific examples.
And there's a dog right there.
And there's my dog, Allie, wanting to participate. Al, are you going to participate in this conversation? She thinks so. And so I think we know it. The knowing of who we are isn't like horses, dogs, reading, architecture. It's a much more wordless knowing, but we know what we're drawn to. And so what I've really found, for me, the reason joy was so important is joy is the quality of living that connects me, gets me out of my head, into my heart, from my heart, out in connection to other people and the world. When I'm in joy, then I know that something is fully connected. So joy is also my sweet spot, my reset button, my litmus test for whether I want to do something. Even if it's something hard, if there's a joy in the facing of that difficult thing, then I know I'm on the right track. So I think we're all encoded with a language also that validates who we are. For me, that language is joy, but for others, it might be love or connection or many other things. But I think our truest self is speaking to us all the time in a language we forget how to listen to.
Yeah, there's a story I remember, and I can't remember where I heard it from, but it's a little girl, probably 4 or 5, and she's talking intently to her newborn sister or brother, right? And her parents come in and see her talking to her, and they say, well, what are you asking? She wants to know what the baby tell her what life is really like, you know, what heaven was really like, because there is an intuitive sense in which we come with as you mentioned, without all the baggage, and then it takes fear to come on, right? Fear is this thing put upon us. Maybe it's fear, maybe it's other things than that, but fear certainly is a big part of it, isn't it? Aren't we taught by our culture, maybe our cultures, to be afraid?
Absolutely. I think the core place that we come from is love. And the core programming is love. And fear comes in and starts to persuade itself that it is more real than love. But fear, like darkness, you know, when you turn on a light, you don't think, where did the darkness go? The darkness didn't go anywhere. When the light is on, the darkness isn't there. And when we are in love, and all of these, for me, joy is what connects me to love, right? And so that's really, I think, what happens is that fear comes in and persuades us, like, well, everybody else is doing it this way. If I don't do it this way, I'm going to be a weirdo. Or how can I make a living just doing what I love? Or if I do this, people will think I'm strange. If I act like this, if I am this way. And so one of the real gifts to me in coming back and finding my truest self was hanging out with a group of people that I thought I would have nothing in common with, which are horror movie fans. I don't like scary movies. I don't like being scared. I don't get the appeal of any of it. But because my dad was a horror movie actor, I go to a lot of horror conventions. And what I find there is love. Here are all these people walking around with, you know, hatchets and costumes and bloody scabs and makeup. And what they're all connecting in is love. And they've come to this genre that's all about fear because, for one reason or another, they felt like they didn't fit in and horror was a place that welcomed them. Consequently, because they have this heart tribe all around them of fellow horror lovers, I have found them to be the most loving, open, kind people in the world. And they're the ones who taught me that to show up as your truest self, even if it's an uncomfortable thing, always returns you to love.
I like that phrase, heart tribe. You know, as I was reading your book, Andrew Harvey came up, and I think I know Andrew Harvey through theologian Matthew Fox, and he talks about the four paths of spirituality, and what you're describing to me of joy and love is that first one, the most important one, in Latin, the via positiva, that way of awe and wonder and joy, and how that is often lost. We forget that's the whole point is, right, of life,
right?
is to be full and joyful. But it doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't sadness or any of that in the world, but we need to embrace that too, right?
Yes. It's not a pie in the sky thing of sort of looking at the world and saying everything is love and God is love and let's pour pink paint all over it. Joy can be found in doing some of the most difficult things, having the conversation you don't want to have, sitting at the bedside of somebody who is ill, or calling somebody who's afraid and being with them through the fear, not trying to take their fear away. I was recently with a friend who had a severe bloody nose in a hotel room, and it wouldn't stop bleeding. And I could feel her fear, and I could feel that fear begin to land on me. I went out into the hall to get some ice bags and ask for extra Kleenex, and I had to go out twice. And the housekeepers were like, oh, my God, it hasn't stopped yet. And I could feel that fear start to land on me, and I could feel her fear. And the job for me wasn't to just poo-poo the fear. The job was for me was to acknowledge that fear and then invite the love in, that light of love that eventually clears the fear. And it happened. I almost watched it happen because I had to show up to the fear in love. It was amazing watching how that really transformed a situation, a scary situation.
Victoria Price is my guest. If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, she's the author of The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self. So what you are now, since 2016, you've, as I interpret, I'll put my interpretation on there and you tell me if I'm wrong, you decided I'm going to handle this fear stuff of letting, of all of the stuff by just letting it go and being on the road and being vulnerable. Tell me, what is that? Am I close? And is this, and what is this road trip, intentional homelessness been for you?
I grew up in a family that was all about accumulation, not in a sort of false sense. My parents genuinely loved collecting art, collecting design, but I grew up feeling the weight of that all around me. You know, I grew up in a 9,000 square foot house in Holmby Hills, California, and my father drove a Rolls Royce, and I went to all the best schools, and it felt like my whole life, what I was supposed to do was kind of barnacle myself with all the things that would make me feel like I belonged in the world, going to the right schools, getting the right test scores, working for the right company, having the kind of job where people sitting next to you on an airplane go, wow, what a cool job. And yet no matter what I did, it always felt like that didn't get to the core place of my true self. It felt always like I was play acting, and often play acting in a play that, you know, I didn't even really want to be in. And I felt like at the beginning, I just tried to chip away at that. And that was wonderful. But the universe kept saying loud and clear, nuh-uh, you're going to have to let this all go. To which I was always answering, are you kidding me? I'm not letting it all go, you know? And at one point, I actually lost pretty much everything and ended up millions of dollars in debt. And I actually rebuilt it all, because I thought that was what you were supposed to do, when the universe was saying, like, look, here's a perfect opportunity. You actually have lost everything. You have the chance to start from scratch. And it wasn't until I'd really done everything right and rebuilt everything that I realized that even doing everything right, I wasn't happy. And so what really had to happen was, over time, I had to let everything go. So for 2 years now, I've been living on the road. And I thought certain things were going to happen. Some have, some haven't. I've thought that if I let certain things go, then other things would come in to fill their place. Or if I let certain things go, I'd have these clear-cut answers. But gradually, I came to think of it as the way of being lost. Like, the way of being lost is a willingness to keep letting go. And yes, things come back in, and you know, nature abhors a vacuum. I've found many different homes, but home doesn't have the same meaning to me that it did. Home really is about a feeling now, not a place. And I wonder really fundamentally whether I will ever have anything that looks like a truly traditional home ever again. And I made my living as a designer, and I still do design work where I create beautiful spaces for people to live in. But for me, that always felt like pressure. And there's something really liberating to me about letting go of all the expectations so that I have to learn how to listen to what my true self is saying. And sometimes what she's saying is I don't know. So we need to be quiet a little bit longer and just listen. And that's not something we're taught to do.
It certainly isn't. The reality is that we come in with nothing and we end up going out with nothing. Life is a series of loss. And what I read in your book, what I'm hearing you saying is that is a way of being, of embracing that reality. Rather than hiding from it or building something else to structure away from it. Go ahead.
Right. Yes, absolutely. You know, I think one of the things that is really fundamentally up for all of us all over the world now is that there is so much global not knowing. There are so many huge cultures, and then, of course, the entire planet in a state of fundamental not knowing. And it's forcing us to develop a new kind of knowing. I've come to believe that the words "I don't know" are a kind of invitation or invocation, and they invite three things, I think. They invite faith. And faith doesn't necessarily have to be in a traditional higher power, but it is in the belief that there is something larger, some kind of larger order or purpose or meaning or infinite entity, whatever it is that you believe, that does know better than your little knowing. When you invite that faith, what comes up big time for all of us is fear. And we have to learn to face our fears. We can't run away from them. Of course, we all want to. I want to every day, but we have to learn to face them. And in that comes this sense of freedom that is not attached to something. You know, we've all had that sense of freedom doing something amazing on vacation, you know, like, oh, I got to do this. I got to hang glide. I got to rappel off a waterfall. I got to zip line. I got to spend 10 days just doing nothing but whatever I wanted or whatever it is. We've all had those kinds of freedoms, but in a way, those are finite freedoms. There's a freedom that comes from literally just being in that place of, I don't know. The word loss is a scary word to people because it has an opposite, which means that there is something you had that you lost. And so to me, the word loss really has this polarizing effect, because then sometimes it swings us back into wanting to gain something back that we've lost. That's certainly what happened to me when I lost everything in my life. I thought, oh, I got to try to get it back. To me, there's something more beautiful about the idea of letting go and free falling into the faith, fear, and freedom of I don't know, and recognizing that there is something larger than all of us that will always take us wherever we need to go. You know, the funny thing is, I like to tell this story about my dad. My dad did he was somebody who always said yes. He had an amazing 65-year career because he said yes all the time. And one of the things he said yes to as a favor to somebody was to do this little poem at the end of this song that was this pop song. And when he got into the studio, he signed this little piece of paper, and the singer signed the piece of paper, and he got paid a little sum of money to do this thing. And the poem was fun, and it only took about an hour, and he had a nice time. Well, it became the biggest selling album of all time. It became Thriller, and the poem was the rap at the end of Thriller, and then my dad's laugh. And my dad was paid nothing. And when it became the biggest selling album of all time, my dad felt kind of dumb that he had literally done this for nothing when everybody said his voice was what made this song so iconic. And so he kind of put out the word, like he wished that they could revisit it. But what he had signed was Ironclad. And I think he felt, you know, silly for having signed away the rights to something huge. And I think he probably felt silly because other people, like his agent or his wife, told him he was. But the thing my dad cared about more than anything in the world was being able to be part of a current conversation with each new generation of young people. My dad was perennially young at heart, and he loved young people because they were curious and interested, and they weren't solid and set in their ways. So my dad has been gone 25 years, and as long as there is Halloween, there will be Thriller. And as long as there is Thriller, people will hear my dad's voice and hear his laugh, and he gets to be a part of that conversation over and over again.
The foulest stench is in the air, the funk of 40,000 years, and grisly ghouls from every tomb are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver, for no mere mortal can resist the evil of the Thriller.
And that is worth more than any little pittance. He got exactly what he always wanted, even though he lost out on some big sum of money. And, you know, I laugh and I think, well, if he'd gotten that big sum of money, you know, maybe I'd be sitting on my island in Bora Bora, you know, enjoying enjoying the sun. But my life, all the loss and all the seeking has come, a lot of it, from not having some of the things that I thought I should have and recognizing that I needed some healing around that. So everything works out perfectly, even though maybe the world might have called that loss, in quotes.
Victoria Price is my guest. The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self is her book. You've written, of course, a book about your father. I want to, for this last question with you, turn actually to your mom and the importance of really moving chapters in here about coming to forgiveness and going to China. Can you talk a little bit about your mom and what forgiveness has meant to you?
Yeah. So my mother and my dad were married for 23 years. When my mom first married my dad, she was this complete free spirit. But fame was difficult for my mom. My dad was built for fame. Fame was the platform that allowed him to spread his joy. For my mom, it was this sense of duty, obligation, responsibility, trying to continue to promote the brand of my dad and keep him in the public eye in the best way possible. And she didn't want to be in the public eye. She was a designer. And it just made her more and more anxious and tense. And then when I came along, I was like a representative of the brand. And anything that I did that I just was a typical kid thing that didn't fit that panicked her, because she thought, how is this going to reflect on her, on my dad? So I grew up with all these messages about what I should or shouldn't do. And you know, I'm really convinced that the word should has been misspelled in the English language, because to me, it's a four-letter word. Anytime we are shoulding all over ourselves, it's not going to turn out well. And so a lot of my life has been this battle between my dad's messages of love and my mother's should-based messages of fear. And I ended up realizing that actually all she really was trying to do was love me and give me the best opportunities she could, but that how her messages came out through the language of fear made me only hear the fear. And so I had this opportunity to go to China, where my mother grew up, and reconnect with her at what was probably the most beautiful time of her childhood, this time of immense possibility and hope, the time she looked back on as being sort of what set the tone for what she wanted for her whole life. And while I was there, I realized all the baggage I was carrying around her, that was her, that I was carrying around in my own life. And basically sort of one by one, I left all that luggage in China and brought home with me a whole new relationship with my mother. But it really took until I became intentionally homeless to let her go completely. I was about three months into being intentionally homeless. And for my mother, you know, stuff and things and image and identity were everything. And there was something about letting everything go that made me realize that one of the things I'd let go in the process was her voice in my head shooting all over me. And so now when I think of my mother, I have only the best. It is just this beautiful, it's like all the beauty and strength and wisdom and creativity and ideas of the messages that she gave me, and none of the shooting. And that's to me what forgiveness is. It's replacing whatever came to us in fear, their fear that they learned from their parents and their parents before them, and recognizing the love that was underneath, and then living that legacy of love forward.
And that's the way of being lost too, isn't it? It's that, I love that image that you used earlier of falling. You fall into, but it isn't into a void. It's ultimately into, well, arms, I would guess. I don't know what that might be. Some kind of experience that, but rather than trying to put it together, you just allow yourself to fall, and somehow there, that's grace.
Yes, that is grace. Exactly.
Victoria Price has been my guest. She's the author of The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self. I look forward to talking with you again to see if there's even a more true self coming out.
Likewise. I'm really excited. I'm working on my next book project already, and I'm really sharing this, what I feel is this really profound strength in in the falling you described.
All right. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me on the show and having this great conversation.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Thanks to the following stations for carrying Progressive Spirit every week: WETS, Johnson City, Tennessee; WEHC, Emory, Virginia; WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina; Kutztown University Radio, Kutztown, Pennsylvania; KCEI, Taos, New Mexico; KACR, Alameda, California; WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin; KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon; KYAQ, Newport, Oregon; KZ88, Kabul, Missouri; KBOG, Bandon, Oregon; 3A Oldies, 91.9 in Epsom, New Hampshire; and welcoming KFOI, Redding and Red Bluff, California; and KPFT, Houston, Texas, as well as WEJP, Wheeling, West Virginia. You can download Progressive Spirit for free on your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow also on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schuck. Be well.